It was one of the biggest scandals the country had ever seen. The theft of U.S. government secrets about the atomic bomb that wound up in the hands of the Soviet Union. The federal government eventually tried and executed Julius and Ethel Rosenberg for conspiracy to commit espionage, sparking an international outcry. Now the story of the Rosenbergs is back in the news, as there's an effort underway to seek a presidential pardon in their case. There's also a new book about their trial by Fresno State professor Lori Kloon, who joins us now. It's called Executing the Rosenbergs, Death and Diplomacy in a Cold War World. Lori, welcome to Valley Edition.
It's great to be here. Thank you.
I think a lot of our listeners probably know something about the Rosenberg case, but maybe even more of them don't know about this couple. The only couple, as I understand it, ever to be tried and executed by the government. Tell me exactly, what were they accused of doing?
So Julius, as we know now, ran a medium-sized military spy ring. And the reason he gets caught up in this particular case is his brother-in-law, David Greenglass, is stationed out at Los Alamos and passing some information to Julius, and then Julius is sending it on to the Soviet Union. When the federal government reacts to the Soviet Union testing its first atomic bomb in 1949 and says, well, spies must have been involved, they look to Los Alamos and find a couple of spies, most famously Klaus Fuchs. His information was crucial for the Soviet development of the bomb. But they look to and they see David Greenglass and they interview him, arrest him, interview him. And he says, oh, yeah, I passed on a few things. I mean, he's a mechanic, so it's not high level stuff necessarily. But he said, yes, I passed it to my brother-in-law, Julius. So then they arrest Julius, and they know because of some top secret documents that they can't disclose in court that he does run this medium-sized spy ring. So the whole thing is to get Julius to talk. So they arrest him, and he won't name the names of the other spies. They arrest his wife to pressure him to talk, as J. Edgar Hoover says, as a lever to get Julius to talk. This was all in 1950.
What charges she face?
Yeah, so they both are conspiracy to commit espionage, which is the easiest thing to get them on, because conspiracy is can be cognizance, right? Do you want to rob a bank? Let's rob a bank. If somebody's sitting next to me and they hear that, they are cognizant of the charge of the crime, and so technically could be conspiracy. So that's where it gets really technical, and the Supreme Court has certainly interpreted it in a couple of different ways, which is why, as we can get to, but the call for President Obama to exonerate is challenging because it's not very clear cut. So it's not conspiracy, or it's not espionage itself. It's conspiracy to commit espionage. And based on the size of their apartment, yeah, she was cognizant. It was a very, very small place. She knew what was going on and was likely very supportive. But she did not have a code name. And from most of the documents, she's not actively involved. In fact, she's spending most of her time raising two rather rambunctious sons. And that's taking up most of her time in this, 1944 to 1950 roughly period.
So we're talking about the initial spark of the Cold War here as the country began its Great Red Scare. And this trial happens. Your book focuses on the trial. Tell me about that process. A lot of these issues deal with government secrets and espionage by the U.S. government as well. Was there tell me about the evidence presented against them.
Yeah, it gets complicated because there are things that can be used in court and things that cannot. So the big thing that cannot be used in court is something called Venona. And these are transcripts that have been ascertained by the federal government. But even President Truman didn't know of this program's existence. That's how top secret it was. And of course, those who are processing that information, it's transcripts of correspondence between the United States and Moscow. And they don't want Moscow to know that the United States has been able to tap into this information, so they can't disclose it in court. And, in court, it's, you have to prove someone guilty. There's an assumption of innocence. And so it's only because of David Greenglass, Ethel's brother, Julius's brother-in-law, because he's willing to testify, that this case can hold up in any way in a court of law. And so they've got David saying, yes, I spied and I gave the stuff to Julius. And initially he says, oh, no, Ethel had nothing to do with this. In the grand jury testimony, by the actual trial itself, he has changed his tune and says, yes, she was involved and she typed reports. We know now that that was a lie. He admitted this in the year 2000 or so, 2001 on 60 Minutes, saying that, no, I lied to save the life of my wife, who actually was a spy and had a code name and actually passed on information. So the trial becomes, you know, his evidence is and testimony is key. But the problem is that this, you know, the Justice Department knows the other stuff. They just can't disclose it in the courtroom. And so they're securing a judge who will be willing to issue the death penalty because they want to use the death penalty, again, to further pressure Julius to talk. It's all about getting him to talk. It's not really about the quality of the information that he passed on. The atomic information particularly is not, it's not high level stuff. It did not save the Soviet Union much time at all in the development of the bomb. But it's something that David Greenglass can testify to. So that's why it's the focus of the trial.
Was it also a media circus to some degree?
Sure, because it's 1950. And the trial 1951, and it's in New York City. And we've just had the trial of the top Communist Party leaders in the same courtroom. Alger Hiss is being sentenced at the same time in the same building. So there's a lot of hype. And I think that's what the hardest part for me was to wrap my brain around. Because when you teach this case, students say, well, this is crazy. This is a couple living in the Lower East Side of Manhattan with two children. How did they, you know, give the Soviet Union the atomic bomb and then cause the Korean War, which is what the judge argued in his sentencing. And so you've got to put it in the context of the incredible fear and paranoia of the time. The belief, certainly by the Truman administration and by many Americans, that communism was on the spread, that now the Soviet Union's got the atomic bomb in 1949, China's a communist country now in 1949. It seemed as if communism was spreading. This was an incredible threat. And, you know, we look back now and go, sure, you know, we're going to duck and cover under a desk and that's going to save our life. It just seems so irrational. But fear is irrational. And I think the fear was palpable. And so the idea of we're going to get these spies because these are the ones we can get. And this will send a signal that these spies are guilty. And anyone who spies could get the ultimate sentence, in this case, of course, death. And that will prove to the world that we're strong. And we can fight the spread of communism. And that's the part I focus on, right? Because I argue because of these documents that they don't actually prove that we're really strong. We are very good at convincing the American people this is the right thing to do. But overseas, it's a different story.
Tell me about that reaction overseas and also here in the U.S. As this conviction was handed down and then the ultimate execution in 1953. What was the public response here and abroad?
Yeah, so here it's very, if you look at Gallup polls and things, Truman, of course, his popularity is wavering a bit because of things that are happening in Korea and the Korean War. But it's never about the Rosenberg case itself. So his popularity concerning the case is fine. Eisenhower's popularity, I don't think, ever dips below 68%, which seems phenomenal today. It's such a high number. The vast majority of the American people believe that this is the right thing to do, that these people are traitorous, that they are spies, and that they should suffer the ultimate penalty. And so, if you will, if it's a propaganda campaign, if it's the spin of the State Department, and in this case in particular, the Justice Department, they do a really good job within the United States of convincing the Americans that these guys are a threat to our national security. Not a word we would have used then, but that's the sense, right? Overseas, even though Truman and in particular Eisenhower are known for their propaganda savviness, they are not able, either of them really, to get ahead of the spin and convince the world, both allies, folks in nations that we used to refer to as third world nations that are kind of up for grabs in the Cold War, come to our side. We're better than the Soviets. Those folks are they're not able to spin the story to convince them that this is the right thing to do. And mostly it's because the evidence against Ethel is so weak, and that translates around the world to what are you doing? She's a mom. And then the large amount of the global population who are opposed to the death sentence at all, that the death penalty is not what a democracy should be doing. So when the Pope comes out against their execution in January of 53, we get this flood of Catholic countries around the world saying, what are we doing? This is not what the United States should be doing. And so the Eisenhower administration at that point can't quite get ahead of how do we convince them, killing people is bad, but this is worse because they're putting the entire world at risk. They can't sell it. And so we've got now, because of State Department documents that we were able to uncover, we've got about 48 countries, 84 cities that have documented protest movements.
We're talking with Fresno State Professor Lori Clune today on Valley Public Radio about her new book, Executing the Rosenbergs, Death and Diplomacy in a Cold War World. It's out on Oxford University Press. How much more do we know about this case now than we did back in 1953 in terms of documents that have come out, other revelations that have been uncovered through the press and through other interviews? And how much don't we know?
We know a great deal now, certainly more than the average American did in 1953, in part because of investigative reporting, in part because of the release of the Rosenberg sons do a Freedom of Information Act request and get their parents' FBI file released in the 70s. And that is, I think, 40,000 pages of documents. And that includes State Department stuff and FBI stuff and CIA stuff. And sure, a lot of redactions, but it fills in the story. When the sons were growing up, they assumed that their parents were honest with them when they said, because the sons were brought to Sing Sing prison to visit their parents while they were still alive on death row, they said, we're innocent. And so the sons really spent most of their lives believing that was true. Why would they think otherwise? The FBI documents proved that Julius ran a military spy ring. And he had many, perhaps a dozen engineers working with him, and they did forward information to the Soviet Union. So, but what the documents also showed was that Ethel was not really a spy. And so they continued this effort as more documents are released, as we get access to Venona transcripts in the 1990s, as David Greenglass is interviewed in 2000, 2001, and he admits, I lied about what my sister's involvement was to save the life of my wife. I had no idea that they would actually execute her. Though, to be honest, he doesn't seem particularly perturbed by that fact, which is a little disturbing. We get that information. We just keep piecing these bits together. When David's wife, Ruth, dies, her grand jury testimony is released. And that's revolutionary because that's when we find out that there is no mention of Ethel doing anything in the grand jury testimony. But she is mentioned in the actual testimony. When David Greenglass dies, we get his grand jury testimony that further confirms. So I suppose part of the final piece is that the documents that a wonderful archivist in College Park, Maryland, where the State Department documents are, when David Pfeiffer was able to find two boxes of missing documents that document this global protest movement. Because until we found those documents, we thought that the protest movement was maybe a couple of people in England and a few people in Paris, and that was about it. And now we know 84 cities, 48 countries around the world. And so that, I think, further tells the story of how this case was a blunder by the Truman and Eisenhower administrations, if the purpose was to convince the world that we're strong and this is the right thing to do, because they were not able to convince so many people around the world that this was the right thing to do.
Is there still information out there that researchers are looking for or hoping to uncover? It seems like in many cases the government maintains classified status on documents going well back past the lifetime of most people live today.
Yes.
Is that the case in this trial?
We know a lot, certainly, but I don't want to say we know everything for sure. Things that have been redacted that we could petition to release those, we'd get further information. A real key is the Soviet archive, or the former Soviet archives, because those were open for, you know, a brief moment in time, and a few historians were able to go there and get some of that information. That's really key, because it's from their perspective, who was spying for them and what were they doing. That window closed relatively quickly to former KGB documents. And so opening that up again would enrich the story much more.
So bring us up to the present day. The two Rosenberg sons are still alive. They were on 60 Minutes last month. I understand you actually did some fact-checking for that
piece. I did. I got to do fact-checking. That was pretty fun. The Rosenberg sons, I think, are remarkable. I don't agree with everything that they're doing, for sure. And that's fine. I mean, I'm a historian, and this is their family story. It's a very different situation.
Do they still maintain the innocence of both their mother and father?
No. So they were there. These are very smart, savvy men, and they acknowledged when the FBI documents were released that their father was indeed a spy. You know, the execution is the part that really trips up a lot of people. That's hard to wrap your brain around. But they certainly continue to believe that the prosecution of their mother was untenable, that was beyond what was legal, certainly. And that's why today, so they were adopted after their parents were executed shortly after. So their last name is now Maripol. And so Robert and Michael Maripol have petitioned President Obama to exonerate Ethel. And they want to say exonerate because pardon implies that she did something wrong, and the president would pardon or forgive. Exonerate is she never should have been tried in the first place. And, you know, I wrote a piece a while back, and actually Michael Maripol replied to me personally about my piece because he disagreed, but he was very gracious about it. But my problem with exoneration is that would mean there was nothing about what she did that could have been prosecuted. And because of the very woodgy kind of definition of conspiracy, technically her cognizance of her husband's espionage activities could be enough. In fact, indeed, it was enough to get her convicted of conspiracy to commit espionage. So I'm not sure that exoneration is legal. I've read other people's interpretations that they say that it is. Other historians who have said absolutely not. Some historians think she was much more active than I believe the documents prove that she was. So it's an interesting case. It's certainly, I think the piece I wrote said exonerate Ethel, no, but apologize for her death, absolutely.
The book is called Executing the Rosenbergs, Death and Diplomacy in a Cold War World. It's by Fresno State History Professor Lori Clune, and it's available worldwide on Oxford University Press. Lori, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks for the opportunity.